Once he had the experience of flying, he could do it by himself. But he was scared stiff the first time he had to do it. It doesn't always work out that we discover we don't need our magic feathers. We all do rely on magic feathers of one sort or another to get through life. And sometimes the feathers help us to discover ourselves, like the kid who relies on a parent holding her bike upright while she gains speed and suddenly discovers that she can keep her balance without any help. And sometimes the feathers keep us from making that discovery. In fact, we can become so dependent on our magic feathers that we shape our lives to them. We end up serving the magic rather than having it serve us. I can tell you a story as an illustration. A friend of ours who works as a consultant had spent many weeks away from home, traveling in cramped airplanes and sleeping in strange beds, eating heavy food and pushing herself to exhaustion. She loves her work and the people she works with, but her schedule was taking a toll on her health and her well-being. "So I sat myself down," she says, "and did what I've always done when I've felt overworked. I counted up all the money I had earned over the last quarter." Then she caught the irony of what she had just done and laughed at herself. The money was nice, but the cost was exorbitant. She had experienced a moment of awareness that enabled her to see what she was doing to herself, and more important, what sort of bargain she was making with herself. She had been using the thought of money as a magic feather. It was supposed to help her fly, and instead it was grinding her down. It's time to set the magic feather aside and let this sermon fly on its own power. My real interest this morning is in the sort of bargains we make with life. The understanding that if we do a particular thing well, we will receive rewards that are commensurate with our efforts. Our friend, the consultant, was very good, or is very good, at what she does and receives good money for her work. But she hadn't taken into account the complexity of the equation. She put a dollar value on her time, but not on her health, not on the amount of stress she experienced, nor on her time away from her family, nor on the time that she was not able to be available for self-care, nor on the muscles in her shoulder that had gone rigid, trying to hold her up as she pushed herself through her schedule. All of those things should be factored into the bargain. But she was putting a price on her hours. And of course, there are those of us who made a bargain with reality by assuming that housing prices and the stock market would continue to rise. And so we ran up debts on our credit cards and refinanced our homes in order to pay off the credit cards, and we bought growth funds instead of bonds and figured that the increasing market value of our homes would keep us solvent in perpetuity. We knew that it couldn't last. We'd seen bubble after bubble burst in the past. Still, we made this bargain with reality. We played the grasshopper rather than the ant. We did not store things aside for the inevitable lean season. Those who put their money into hedge funds or subprime mortgage packages put their faith in the numbers. It seemed that a perpetual motion machine had finally been created. 10,000 scenarios had been run on the computers, and the system always came out ahead. The numbers became a higher reality. Some companies were even selling insurance against losing in the stock market. Some of you may have bought that insurance. Some of you may even have sold it. Somehow we forget that a cycle of prosperity that brings untold wealth to a few while leaving the majority of the people with less and less cannot endure. In our excitement and astonishment, we forgot the basic principle, to use biblical terms, of caring for the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner. And when those who had believed in the numbers when they purchased a house found that they could no longer keep up with the numbers as their adjustable mortgages adjusted, The time of foreclosures brought devastation to everyone. As we work our way out of this debacle, we may well find that that guidance comes from some very old religious realities. The Hebrew concept of shalom, after all, which we know to mean health or well-being, refers not to the individual, but the health of the entire community. We need to be looking for ways as we get ahead that we bring the rest of the community along with us. Let's look at another example, marriage. I counsel couples who ask me to officiate at their weddings to set a couple of hours aside in which they write down what they think it means to be married and what they're promising to each other. In effect, I ask them to come up with the substance of their vows. And people make the most outlandish promises to each other at their weddings. To stand by each other in sickness and in health, with little thought of how devastating some sicknesses can be and how threatening they can be, not just to the relationship, but also to the mental health of the spouse. To take each other for better or for worse, even though they have been very careful not to show their worst all during the courtship. To take each other for richer or for poorer, with little understanding of what either unaccustomed poverty or unaccustomed wealth can mean in terms of a person's sense of identity and values. And most couples enter into marriage with the thought that any differences they discover will be reconcilable, while in truth, the majority of differences are not amenable, at least not the significant differences. They're not amenable to easy fixes. Differences in religion, for instance, may always pull a couple in separate directions, never going away, no matter how much the couple tries to talk them through. The same goes for the tensions between career and relationship, both of which are so important to our sense of who we are, and which pull us in different directions all the time. Or consider differences regarding children, how many to bring into the world, or how to parent them. Even when the couple agrees about the basic questions regarding children, how many newlyweds are ready to consider how children alter one's identity? Or how our hopes for our children can become manacles for us and for them? Or how tense the parent-child relationship can become and how long that tension persists? So promises made within the huppah promises are made within the confines of the huppah, and then the couple goes forth into the real world to discover what the words really mean. What counts in the long run is less the shape of the vision or the shape of the promises than it is the couple's ability to accept and tolerate the changes and the differences that they will inevitably experience. None of us knew what we were bargaining for when we married. I think perhaps we should reframe our thought processes when considering such a commitment. Instead of asking ourselves, is this the person I want to spend my life with? We should be asking, is this the person who will help me grow? Help me grow to meet the unseen challenges that life will bring us. And am I the person to help her or him grow? Those questions would bring us closer to the actual dimensions of the bargain that we're making with each other and with life. The third area I'd like to consider this morning has to do with what we think life is about. I recently started leading studies of both the Sufi poets, who are mystics trying to convey in poetry their experience of connection with the divine, and Thoreau's Walden, which poses the question, what is life all about when you strip away the trappings of society and experience being without any kind of mediating preconception. Both are concerned to move beyond what we've learned to value and get in touch with a higher or a deeper reality. Their ideas challenge us to see the world differently or to see ourselves differently, to renegotiate the bargain that we have made with life. As I read them, I find myself feeling defensive, inadequate sometimes, or just plain puzzled. I want to explain the choices I have made and the values I hold. I want to say, but you guys never married. You never had children. You had opportunities open to you that were never presented to me. I know in my heart all these quibbles are self-serving, and I feel silly as I listen to myself say them. Rumi, the Sufi poet, answers that in marriage and parenting, I learn about love and responsibility. And that should teach me something about how God loves me, what God hopes for me. And I have to figure out what that means within my own sphere of discourse, where God has always been a puzzling idea rather than a guiding reality. What's the nature of this love that Rumi has experienced? Similar to that gaze of blessing that Barbara Peskin described in our opening words. Can I really get there by way of domestic affection? And does this higher love provide a redeeming bargain with life? Thoreau answers my complaints by posing, in essence, the question that Dr. Phil has made famous. So, how is that working for you? Are you one of those living a life of quiet desperation? What is the condition of your soul? Do you ever consider the condition of your soul? Have you sold it for a false sense of well-being and security? Faust got a better bargain. Rumi tells us that every new experience prepares us for experiences that will follow, and that we should accept whatever comes to us as a guest and a guide. Don't fight reality. Learn from it who you really are, he says. Each new experience is both an opportunity and a test. Pay attention and learn who you really are and what really matters. This learning is never completed, but it grows deeper and more sustaining as we face more and more challenges. But the learning never happens if we continue to think in terms of what might be fair, or what we deserve, or how this might look to others. Saving face, says Thoreau, is far less important than saving soul. And saving soul requires that we try some self-discipline, some new form of austerity, which we practice for its own sake. Austerity because our soul has become flabby. Practice with enough determination, and eventually that act, that austerity that we practice, will reacquaint us with reality. Now there's faith. Fortunately, Rumi is compassionate, and he says in return, even our ill-humored responses help bring us closer to that overwhelming love we so want and so fear. See the yearning that lies beneath the spitefulness. I love that. See the yearning that lies beneath the spitefulness. We're only looking at our life bargain in terms of its cost. Look also at its benefits. Learn to discern them and value them because of what they have cost us. And learn to value the struggle we've gone through. It has given us strengths we don't know yet how to perceive. And Thoreau comes in again to remind us that the world offers us a kind of music. The wind in the trees, the conversation of people in a restaurant, the movement of clouds, the rumble of trucks on the parkway, the laughter of children, the sizzle of frying bacon, the beeping of cell phones, the colors of azaleas in the spring, the smoothness of icicles, humidity in July, the jumble of junk mail that falls every day through the mail chute, the ticking of clocks, the calls of geese flying overhead, the overly loud commercials on television, the rustle of silk, all contribute to the music if we can just allow them to share their song with us. Ultimately, our job is to learn how to hear music rather than distracting noises and let the music carry us. And I want to reply, by going into the woods for 2 years? I can't do that. And Thoreau responds by listening for the music. It doesn't really matter where you are. You carry the distractions with you, even into the woods. find your music and let it carry you. It reminds me of Winnie the Pooh getting his hum going. Renegotiate your bargain with life. And then Rumi adds, find the music and let it carry you back to its source, which is also your source and your consolation and your consummation. It's all in the fine print. That's part of the bargain. You just have to know that it's there.